From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for Cynthia Canty. Today on the program, Michigan is the fourth largest craft beer state in the nation, and things are shifting with mergers, closings, and openings.
We probably have too many breweries right now for the marketplace to support. If anything, we're seeing a correction in the state. The last 2-3 weeks have been a bit of a bloodbath.
Some small brewers say state law is prohibiting further growth and expansion of the industry.
But it feels like behind the scenes that some of these larger breweries, it doesn't necessarily benefit them, so they're not necessarily pushing for a change.
We'll dive into the politics of craft beer. Also, the UAW strike against GM is stretching into week two.
I would say within 2-4 weeks, you're going to start to see some big impacts nationally.
All of that and more coming up on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for Cynthia Canty. Thanks for joining us. Coming up later on the program, we'll talk about the politics of craft beer in Michigan.
The wholesale system is the most efficient way, cost-effective way to get beer to the marketplace.
But first, the UAW strike against General Motors is now stretching into its second week. Detroit Free Press columnist John Gallagher says it's unclear where the tipping point is, but if the union and GM don't reach a deal soon, there will be a larger economic implication for the region and beyond. John Gallagher joins us now. John, welcome.
Hi, Laura. How you doing?
All right. So even if it isn't clear exactly where that tipping point may be, when would we begin at least to feel that broader impact of a strike, do you think?
Well, I think the workers are already hurting because they've lost a week's paycheck, and the strike pay they get from the UAW doesn't make up for that. They also have to pay for their own health care because GM has decided not to continue health care for the workers. So they're already hurting. You know, analysts differ on when GM itself starts to hurt, but probably by the second or third week, they'll be losing enough money that they'll start to feel it. And then the big question is, when does it really work its way into the broader economy? You know, we think that the auto industry is all assembly plants and metal bending, but there's a lot of infotainment systems that go into this that are made on the West Coast, places like California, Silicon Valley. It's a major supplier to the auto industry today. So I think that pretty soon, I mean, I would say within 2-4 weeks, you're going to start to see some big impacts nationally on this.
Well, yeah, you write that the effects would cascade throughout the economy. What might those ripple effects look like regionally or throughout the state?
Right. Well, originally, you know, you have the UAW workers on strike cannot spend as much money as they were. So they cancel vacations, you know, they buy a cheaper kind of grocery or whatever. So that's sort of the immediate thing. But beyond that, you begin to see the spread beyond the cities where the auto plants are being picketed because all the supplier plants start to shut down. And as I said, some of the even software companies or electronics companies may be hit. Then you start to get that ripples into the broader economy, and you start to see maybe fewer mortgages being made or fewer bank loans or you know, kids are not going to take that vacation during summer break that they hope to take because their parent is on strike. So it begins to ripple into that broader economy the longer it goes. And again, we don't know exactly when, but certainly if it goes a month, I mean, that would start to entail a pretty heavy toll on the U.S. economy.
After the last economic downturn or the Great Recession, we really talked about diversifying our economy in the state so that it wasn't, you know, something happening to the auto industry wouldn't have such an impact here. Do you think the state has been able to diversify enough that the impact would be less felt, or do you think that we're still sitting in that area where it would hurt us all if the auto industry took such a downturn?
Well, we are more diversified, but mainly because manufacturing has become much less of a dominant factor in the U.S. economy, and even in Michigan's economy. It used to occupy a much bigger place in Michigan's gross domestic product. It used to be something like 25% of the total output of Michigan's economy was automotive, and now it's about 8%. So we have diversified. And that's a cushion. That helps a little bit. But, again, that presumes that the industry is up and running and everybody's happy and everybody's working. And if you shut down a good, you know, the biggest company in the industry for 2, 3, 4, 5 weeks, you know, obviously that's going to have a big impact. So I think the thing everybody agrees with is that the longer this goes, the worse it gets.
Well, you also say that the larger and longer effect could be on culture at General Motors and within the auto industry. How so?
Well, that, I think that's a really overlooked point here. But for many years now, the auto companies and the UAW have portrayed themselves as partners. And when you hear, say, an auto company CEO talk about the union, it's not like, you know, the workers are bad guys. It's, no, these are our partners. We're working hand in hand with them to produce shared goals and shared sense of purpose. And it doesn't always work out, you know, on the line in reality. But that's sort of the goal and the rhetoric for many years now, that the union and the auto companies are partners. And this begins to endanger that. A very short strike, you know, you blow off a little steam, you make your point, then you go back to work. But one that lasts for a month is going to really set up some bitterness that's going to be hard to break down. And I think that the auto companies need to understand that the internal culture is an important thing that they have to keep working on. I mean, they don't want workers discontented. You know, that adds to sort of absenteeism and turnover and, you know, more mistakes in production and all that kind of stuff. I mean, culture is really important. And a strike like this, if it goes on too long, you see the danger that that's going to be a big problem going forward.
John Gallagher with the Detroit Free Press, thanks so much for joining us today.
You bet, Laura. Anytime. Thank you.
The Michigan Republican Party gathered on Mackinac Island over the weekend, and if you heard about it, you probably heard about the big guest, Vice President Mike Pence. He brought a motorcade to the otherwise carless island. But the real news off the island is how the party faithful are feeling going into a presidential election year with President Donald Trump as their leader and a new way of drawing district lines on the horizon. One man on Mackinac Island for the conference was John Selleck, CEO of Harbor Strategic Public Affairs. John, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So conferences like these are designed to drum up enthusiasm for the party. What was the mood this year?
They are intended to do just that. And I think that's important to remember that. It's not a public-facing event. It's not meant to inform the public of what's going on. It is a decades-long traditional event for people to take a break from everything else they're doing, going up and see one of Michigan's crown jewels, Mackinac Island.
It's a pep rally.
And have some time to connect. It is a pep rally. And every pep rally is a little bit different. And this year is a little bit different in the sense that Michigan Republicans aren't fighting over who their presidential nominee be. And they're not, at this time, fighting over who their U.S. Senate nominee will be. That's probably John James. So in effect, what they had the ability to do is go up there. They're not having a, quote, civil war or a battle, and get focused on the general election for next year and get excited about that instead of a fight leading up to a fight with the Democrats.
And yet Politico reports that the Trump reelection campaign is actually a bit worried about its chances of retaking Michigan in 2020. What was that concern being expressed at all on the island? Were there whispers of that as well?
Well, I think you could write that same headline every single election cycle. There's a reason they call us a purple state. We're red, we're blue, depending on the election cycle. And certainly the president won by the thinnest of margins, a little over 10,000 votes last time. Other people attributed that victory to Hillary Clinton and her failure to turn out and mobilize Michigan's urban centers. And those are questions for this election that are still up in the air, because we don't know who President Trump's opponent will be. Right now, in a lot of polling, it shows that Joe Biden, if he were the nominee, would be leading by quite a bit. If he's not the nominee, a lot of polling shows that nearly all the other Democratic candidates are in a dead heat with the president within the margin of error, so to speak. And for the first time, as we watch Iowa, we see that Elizabeth Warren has passed Joe Biden in a poll there for the first time. So the Democrat side is really undecided. And that leaves the Republicans focused just on the fact that of their support on the president and his policies. And they're just sort of brooding for the fight. They're waiting to find out who are we taking on in round one.
John, you've worked for Republican officials for many years, including Mitt Romney's presidential campaign. That seems like a far cry from where the party is nationally. Do you think that those shifts are happening here in Michigan as well? Could you feel a difference in the way the party looks?
Well, one way to judge the conference is how many of your old friends and buddies that you've been through the wars with over the years, so to speak, are there. And frankly, I see all the same faces. They are Republicans. They've been Republicans their whole lives, and they're committed to the party. it would be silly to think that there aren't people who are attending who have that don't agree with the president on every single issue or have misgivings about the direction of the administration on some issues. Mm-hmm. Those kind of things are talked about. But overall, what you find at a meeting like this is the fear of what a progressive candidate would bring in the presidency, like putting in Medicaid for all or other ideas that are perceived to be radical there. It seemed to be more dangerous to the folks that show up at these meetings than anything that they might be concerned about with the current administration.
Well, I was going to say, is the fear more based in social and cultural change or in policy change?
Well, I definitely think, first and foremost, it's policy. Polling even shows today that even independent voters and some Democrats who have private health insurance now, which is not only key to your health, but your fiscal health, the idea that that could be taken away and fumbled off to the government in a way that might provide you with higher expenses and worse care is something that turns off a ton of voters. And that is a key policy issue that ruled the roost in 2018 healthcare, and we're seeing it come into 2020.
But on the other hand, Donald Trump has come in with policy shifts that have been incongruous to what has traditionally been Republican priority. For instance, putting tariffs in against China.
Sure. And you certainly find people who have disagreements with the president on those issues. But they've also seen the president, if you did an informal survey of folks that attended the meetings, you'd probably find that they agreed with him on cutting taxes. They agreed with him on standing up to and fighting China on trade policies and some of the international stance he's taken, for example, against Iran. So you'd still find a number of policy issues where people in the party still are agreeing with this president and see a turn to a socialist-based policy as a huge negative, one that would cause them to never leave the party that they've been a part of for a long time.
John, lastly, the state GOP is suing to change or stop how the new redistricting commission would work. What's the talk among party leaders and faithful about the future of the redistricting process? What are the major concerns?
I think there are concerns about the redistricting committee, about how many folks are automatically excluded from participating in it. Is that really fair? Is it too restrictive constitutionally? Those are fights that thankfully can be decided in the courts and not in an endless discussion on great shows like yours, but we can finally get an answer and then set the ground rules once and for all going into the elections.
John Selleck, CEO of Harbor Strategic Public Affairs, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Coming up next on Stateside, the politics of beer.
Our self-distribution limit is extremely prohibitive.
That's next on Stateside. Stick with us. Stateside, I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for Cynthia Canty.
When the six-pack starts to roll, things start happening.
One of the more exciting industries in Michigan over the past decade has been the craft beer industry.
Good friends and a good beer don't come easy. So when you find them, you hold on to them.
We have seen rapid expansion with more than 350 breweries, making us the fourth largest beer state in the nation. And if you've purchased beer just about anywhere lately, you've probably noticed the local craft beer section has really grown. But some brewers say that section may not be as big as it could be. They argue that state law is prohibiting small breweries from growing, even to just medium-sized. Here's how the law works. Brewers are allowed to self-distribute their products to restaurants and grocers if they produce fewer than 1,000 barrels annually. Beyond that 1,000 barrel cap, they must sign on to work with a distribution company to take their product and sell it on their behalf. It's called the three-tier system. Here to explain the three-tier system is Michigan Public Radio's Rick Pluta. Rick, welcome.
Hi, glad to be here.
All right, you have 30 seconds to describe to me the three-tier system. Go.
Ha! So post-prohibition, Michigan, like a lot of states, created a system where the idea was that no single entity would dominate the process. And so we've got the creators, the brewers, and the distillers. We've got the distributors, who are the middleman. And then we've got the retailers, the people who actually sell it to the public. And the idea was that no single entity, organized crime, whatever, would be able to dominate the process. That's why we have the three-tier system.
You made it! Good for you. That's perfect, Rick. Thank you.
Perfect.
Okay, so some small breweries would like to see that 1,000 barrel cap extended to 30,000 barrels before they have to work with a distributor. In Ohio, for example, the cap for craft breweries is 1 million barrels. Michigan brewers argue that a higher cap gives them more of a fighting chance to become viable and grow, maybe even become the next household name like Bell's or Founders. Two of these brewers are Dane Barch of Eastern Market Brewing in Detroit and Dan Riley of Axel Brewing in Ferndale, which recently folded as a company and has sold its assets to Eastern Market. Dane and Dan, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
All right. This may be the unpleasant place to start, but Dan, I think it's important that we talk about what happened to Axel. I know there's a lot of twists and turns to it, but if you could paint a picture with a broad brush, what would you say?
Our biggest challenge was, in order for us to grow, we had started to see stronger growth outside of the tap room in our draft sales, but at our scale, our margins were so lean. Seriously, like less than 5% on the draft side, and almost non-existent on the package side. And so in terms of looking at what our long-term future looked like, based on the money we invested up front and the time we spent only in distribution, we didn't see a clear path to profitability across the enterprise. And it was tough, it was a bittersweet decision, but fundamentally we believe in what we built in the community and we had a great response to people, but ultimately we're in a business and we have to have a path to making money.
So of the many small batch or craft breweries that we see in the state, how many are facing similar conundrums?
I think we're not necessarily a bellwether for the industry because we came into it from a very different standpoint. I think the biggest challenge a lot of breweries have is that they will start producing, they have an expertise in making beer, and before they've really gotten a firm hold on what their brand is, they sign with a distributor to expand the reach of product. They don't really consider the self-distribution option because the limit we have in the state, as we'll talk more about, is really prohibitive to doing that. And essentially, from a very early stage, they've relinquished the most critical touch point in their brand outside of the tap room. And it's not unlike what the auto companies have dealt with for years relative to the dealer network in terms of trying to control that consumer touch point. But I do think that a lot of small brewers are facing similar things to us, where the scale, in order to be able to make money and to have a decent enough margin with a wholesaler involved in the middle, you have to be able to make beer really efficiently. And the cost of goods across the industry have gone up dramatically. You know, the cost of cans and aluminum have continued to grow. Packaging costs go up. And so it's much more difficult than it looks like on the surface. And I think, you know, there's different breweries at different levels, but depending on their point in their growth, many who are significantly larger than Axel was are facing a very similar conundrum because they've maxed out essentially what they can do in their taproom spaces.
Right.
And they're looking to out of state to grow. But in order to do that, they have to have wholesalers involved. And it's a very big endeavor.
So, Dane, what's the problem with needing to make beer extremely efficiently in order to make it work? It seems to me like that's sort of, the free market system. It would be those who can make it the leanest are going to make it in the large scale as well.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about craft beer, a lot of people say it's like the macros versus these small brewers. And at the end of the day, like we're creating a quality product that people pay a little bit more for. So we're not necessarily competing with someone like a Bud Light or a Miller Light. And for like our business in particular, and a lot of small breweries, we're not competing for shelf space. So for us, and especially like someone like me who's new to the industry, I wanted to figure out like what we made well, what our customers wanted before I jumped in the distribution game and tried to compete with someone like a Bud Light or a Miller Light. Or like in our case, we never have that aspiration. That's not something that's really interesting for us. And so we realized pretty early that we probably couldn't compete through distribution, especially if we went through a distributor. And even if we could, we couldn't do it as effectively as someone that has a larger scale or even some of the large craft breweries in Michigan like a Bell's or a Founders who are doing it at scale. So we really focused on the product in our tap room and the experience within the tap room. and then started to dabble in distribution, which we've actually found some success in, but it's taken us a little bit of time to get there and understand what would work well in the market.
So tell me what's prohibitive about going and working through a distributor.
Yeah, so the problem is, I mean, if you think about, you know, Founders or Bell's, they're operating in these giant systems. If you do a tour of their facilities, it's just like breathtaking. If you go to a small brewery like ours, as an example, you can literally see all the tanks right when you walk in the door, and they're small. And so we if we want to go and compete with them, we generally, based on the current laws, have to sign on with a distributor. And the problem is distributor takes generally around a 30% cut, sometimes more, sometimes a little bit less. But you don't really have any leverage in that discussion because you're forced to sign on with them. And so you're going
the leverage in discussion of what cut they take?
Yeah, any of the
deal points, right?
Yeah. Or even how much the beer is selling for in the grocery store?
Dan, you can probably talk about this more than me.
There's some influence there, but you also, it's somewhat what the market will bear as well. I mean, regardless of what your cost side is, certain categories of beer are only going to demand a certain price point. Yeah. And essentially, to Dane's point, is while we're not overtly competing with Bell's and Founders because we see them as very different businesses, you know, your standard beer buyer will pay a premium for something well-made, much mm-hmm. closer to home, but there's a certain limit to what that is. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, you end up working backwards. And then the reality is most small brewers then try to get more efficient with their cost of goods, their labor, and that's a very difficult proposition when you're essentially competing on such a broad-based scale.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Dane Bartsch of Eastern Market Brewing in Detroit and Dan Riley of Axel Brewing in Ferndale. So you're talking about roadblocks that essentially, they don't stop a small brewery from turning into a large one. It's about going from small to medium in the national scale, because we're not even talking about going to a Bud Light size. We're talking about being the ability to grow to a Bell's or a Founder's side, right?
And even, I would say, short of that. Yeah. I mean, it's this may be a cynical viewpoint, but I don't think we're going to see another Bell's and Founders in the state of Michigan. I think a lot of their success and scale came with being the first movers in the space. Mm-hmm. And in a burgeoning, growing industry, I think most, you know, of your, what I would call, I guess, the third or fourth wave of craft brewers, particularly in the state, are a little more constrained about what that ambition looks like. They want to keep their region closer to home. Most are focused on the state. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the numbers that the Bell's and Founders do of the world, the north of 400,000 barrels, that's not even in the scope of the conversation.
Yeah.
I mean,
right.
People are looking to get to 15 to 20.
Right.
You know,
2,000.
2,000, right. 3,000. So I think it's a matter of a leverage point. And I also think that one of the things that you struggle with is that when you're a small brewery, you're a brand in its infancy. Mm-hmm. And every incremental thing you do is a reflection of how people are going to connect with that brand. Mm-hmm. And it's a time where you build your values. It's a time where you have a lot of face-to-face and one-on-one communication with your customers. Mm-hmm. And to give that up at such an early stage when you've barely gotten your feet wet, it is pretty difficult decision.
Well, what's the problem, Dane, with staying a very small business? I mean, I think if brewers were viewing themselves more on the scale of being a restaurant or mm-hmm. just a tap room rather than trying to expand beyond that, what would be the problem with saying that's enough or that's okay? Yeah.
I actually don't think there's a problem with that. And I think the vast majority of breweries are starting to think like that. And the ones that aren't are the ones that are starting to find some trouble, and they mm-hmm. will in the not so distant future. There's a lot of breweries that just want to stay small and focus on their consumers and their community and sell beer directly to those people. But all that we're thinking about through self-distribution is the ability to grow past that if you'd like to. And a lot of people don't think self-distribution is even worth the effort that it would take. And with the current limit, there's actually some breweries that will hit that limit just in sales out of their tap room. So they wouldn't be able to sell their beer even if they wanted to beyond their actual physical location, just because the limit is so low in Michigan.
Dan, I know Axel was getting close to that very situation.
Oh, well, yeah, we weren't self-distributed, so we didn't really think about that. But yeah, I mean, it for a facility of our size doing 1,000 barrels in a tap room is a fairly easy, not easy, but it's a fairly
common
mark to hit. And I think Dane kind of touched on it, and you started to a little bit in that I think it's more relative to the landscape of the rest of the country right now. Our self-distribution limit is extremely prohibitive. And the reality is that, it's nothing surprises me at this stage of my life, but I'm surprised how much resistance there is to growing and expanding the cap, because fundamentally, I think one in maybe 10, maybe not even that, will actually consider making the capital investment in logistics, in trucks, in delivery systems, in supply chain management, in product planning.
To even take it beyond 1,000.
Yeah, and the reality is, whether it's, you know, the initial petition was asking for 30,000. I don't want to speak for Dane, but as someone who's, you know, now in a position where I'm observing the industry, I'm also in the process of selling a brewery. In a building that my partner and I own. So, and I do have a long-term vested interest in the health of the industry. What baffles me a little bit is, having a background in other businesses, is that if the cap is raised enough where people can invest in their brand managers, their salespeople, some infrastructure, fundamentally, if they're successful, they're going to be butting up against that revised cap fairly quickly. And then, instead of taking on, you know, a brand in its infancy who may know nothing about branding or marketing or packaging, a wholesaler then can make a really informed decision looking at someone and saying, hey, you know what? Eastern Market Brewing has 10,000 barrels of distribution. We can immediately capture that and grow that by X. Yeah. But what it also does is it changes the conversation, to Dane's first point. There's more of a give and take. You can go out and interview wholesalers with a little bit of leverage, because fundamentally, if you have a $3 million distribution business, it's worth $3 million plus X.
So it's not about begging into a system. It's about having options, essentially. Yeah. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, you mentioned free market. And for us, it's just the ability to have that choice, right? I actually find a lot of value in distributors. I think at a certain size, it doesn't make sense to not use a distributor.
Absolutely.
Because I don't want to be a logistics company. I don't want to be focused on truck routes. But at our size, we can do that pretty easily in-house. And then, just like Dan said, you get to a point where you're big enough, you actually can go to a distributor and actually have value. Be like, hey, if you guys want to take on this business, you instantly have access to these accounts. Our beer is already there. You just take it over and handle the logistics of it. So I think it makes sense. And when you talk to distributors, there's some that are very much on the same page, where they're like, I see the value in that. I don't actually want to work with a brewery that can only do 200 barrels of distribution in
a year. It seems like they would want a company to come to them that's medium size and going to provide more business for them as well in some ways. All right. So let's talk about the roadblocks. What's standing in the way? Who's standing in the way, or anything standing in the way from changing this, if this is the norm for many other states to have a much higher barrel threshold?
Yeah, so all the states in the Great Lakes region have a limit of 10,000 barrels or more.
Wisconsin, Minnesota, Illinois,
Ohio is basically unlimited. They have a million barrel limit that you can actually apply and go above it if you ever
Indiana's
get to that point.
Indiana's up to 90K, I think, now in self-distribution.
Yeah, 10 is basically like the lowest threshold. Okay. So it's kind of interesting.
Except for 1,000 here.
Except for 1,000 here. Maine used to be 1,600, and they just boosted theirs to 30,000.
Okay.
30,000 is kind of the consistent number across the industry, and most states have a limit around that area.
So based on the national average, 10,000 is not a large ask.
No. Okay. And so that begs the question, what's different about our state that's known for craft beer? And I think one of the things that I've come to realize over the past few months is that we have a couple breweries that are very large that have kind of, up until now, kind of dominated sales within the state and outside of Michigan.
Have we already mentioned them in this conversation?
We have.
Are they Bells and Founders?
They are. Yes. Okay. Yeah. And neither of them are openly against the self-distribution cap. But what I've found kind of through our conversations is that up until now, it's always been kind of like distributors versus everybody else. But when you start to talk to distributors about this issue itself, you realize that they actually see value in increasing the cap. And that if you increase it, like just like we talked about, you'll actually have breweries that are providing value to them, and it helps the whole industry. You talk to retailers, like we love all of the bars and restaurants that we work with, and they like working with us because we can be a little bit more nimble than a distributor. If they need a beer on a Friday, then I can make sure our sales guys are there to take care of them. So they see a lot of value. So all three tiers of the system are for the most part on board, and the general public is definitely on board with the changes. But it feels like behind the scenes that some of these larger breweries, it doesn't necessarily benefit them, so they're not necessarily pushing for a change.
And I think that may create more competition for them ultimately.
That's what I think it is. It also just doesn't help them. One of the other issues that we haven't talked about is franchise law. So once you sign with a distributor, you actually can't break the contract. They can sell it to someone else. They can sell it back to you on whatever price they want. So that's one of the issues that we're running into, is that breweries that have already signed with the distributor can, even if we change this law, it's not going to benefit them.
So that gets to the beer and wine wholesalers lobby. A very powerful lobby for all intents and purposes in Lansing. Are they standing in the way of changing this law?
So first of all, they're very difficult to get with directly. So it's hard to have a conversation with them directly. But from what I hear, they're actually open to increasing the limit. And from my understanding, legislation is being written to increase the limit right now that they are in support of. The question is what that limit becomes. And so they're open to increasing it. 30,000 is something that they would never agree to. Even something like 10,000 barrels, I think there's going to be a lot of reluctance. But somewhere between where we are now and 10,000, from what I hear, and again, it's very hard to have a direct conversation with them, they are open to that concept. And potentially, we could see a law change this fall. But I think there's a lot that's up in the air right now.
All right, so we have to wrap up, but I have to know, is this something that we're going to see lawmakers actually tackle, in your opinion, in the next term or so?
I think so. I think there is an appetite, because I think ultimately those who don't support it are really reluctant to be public about that. It just is not a good look.
That was Dan Riley of Axel Brewing and Dane Bartsch of Eastern Market Brewing in Detroit. Stateside reached out to Founders, which declined an interview opportunity. We also reached out to the Michigan Beer and Wine Wholesalers Association. They have yet to respond to the request for comment. Up next, we'll speak with Larry Bell of Bell's Brewing. That's next on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber-Davis, in for Cynthia Canty. If there's one beer brand that serves as a shining example of the culture and possibilities of Michigan's craft beer industry, it's arguably Bell's Brewing out of Kalamazoo. Its Two-Hearted IPA is celebrated as one of the best, most award-winning craft beers in the nation. Bell's founder, Larry Bell, began brewing beer in the 1980s, before small batch brewing was in vogue, and he became a champion for the craft brew industry in the state and beyond. The industry in Michigan as it exists today is credited in no small part to the work of Larry Bell. And he joins us here today. Larry Bell, welcome.
Thank you so much.
So what drew you to it? How did you know that brewing and creating your own beers was something you'd be interested in?
My dad had been a home winemaker, and he made good wine at home. And I collected beer cans. I was interested in different flavors in beer. And so the idea of being able to make your own beer, you know, I was poor. I lived in a house with three other guys. We had no money. Hey, we can make beer cheap at home. I think I can do this. And I bought a book. It's a terrible, terrible book, but there wasn't anything available at that time. And started brewing some beer in the basement and kind of caught the bug then.
For your own consumption. It was just for you, for a hobby, but also...
In the beginning.
Yeah.
And then things got a little out of control. And there came a time where I either had to fish or cut bait. And either I was going to get a license to make beer professionally, or I probably was going to wind up in jail.
So does tasting new beers and the discovery of what is it possible still interest you? Or are you kind of at the point where, you know, this is my job and yes, I have to taste beer, but maybe you've lost the love for it.
No, I always enjoy visiting another brewery and trying out their beers and seeing what they're up to. I've had the chance to visit some really cool breweries, to go to Orval in Belgium and Weinsteffen in Germany and see what they have. So I think that's interesting. You know, we really take a look these days also at what people are doing quality-wise. We have a lot of interest in that, in what are the tools that we can use from a quality perspective. There are always things going on in brewing from a scientific standpoint.
Yeah.
And we have a great lab staff that I encourage to publish.
To me, some of what you're talking about and in general, the craft beer industry seems to be edging more towards the wine industry, especially the way maybe it felt in Napa 20, 30 years ago. I'm curious if you view now beer and wine as being part of a same level of sophistication, even within the industry.
Well, I think you're exactly right. I've always said it, that, you know, we're a generation behind what happened to wine out west.
Where do you think Michigan fits into that picture, especially if we're talking about Napa Valley? And I think of the origin of fine wines in America being obviously in California. Does Michigan sort of rank that way for beer?
I think we've always had a good reputation for beer. We have, we're one of the states with the most number of breweries, just sheer number of breweries. I think we're number five in the country. So we sort of over-index for a number of breweries. And yeah, we've just always had a good reputation, and I think had a reputation for having some innovation and high-quality beers. So I think we hold up very well in the national picture and the international picture of what we're out there doing.
Larry, I want to talk to you about this issue of self-distribution. The claim is by some of the guys out of the smallest of the business side that they would like to self-distribute more barrels than they are currently able to. They think that there are several things standing in the way from the law being changed, and that the biggest fish in the small brewery, craft brewery pond, being Founders and Bell's, are sort of standing in the way of that from happening. Do you think that this is becoming a showdown, or how do you feel in general about that barrel number?
Well, I think it's a really complicated issue, and you have to understand it's not just a brewing world issue. It involves the whole industry. First off, you have to realize that every successful brewery in the state of Michigan, over 1,000 barrels, has done it using the current distribution system. Bell's, Founders, Shorts, Atwater, everybody who's been there has gone through that system. Second, we already support our small brewers in the state with a tax differential, which is a bill that I first passed, I think, in 1991 and has been expanded. So we have done a lot of things for small breweries that we have found successful. And the bill was signed in 1992 that I was a big part of that traded away the right to self-distribution for the right to sell beer by the glass in the state. So pretty much
Right. Everybody
in the state is doing that. That was the deal. So it's hard for me to get involved because I made a deal way back then. The other part is you have to understand that it's not just about brewers. It's about other wholesalers. It's about those folks on the retail side of things, whether they're a bar or a licensed restaurant. So in other states where we've seen expanded self-distribution, and what we're seeing with explosion of brew pubs and microbreweries is the degradation of our restaurant trade. So sort of the open market. Coming out of Prohibition, we came up with a three-tier system, and it was about choice, having choice for consumers. So that Class C licensee can offer a wide variety of products to the consumer, as opposed to before Prohibition, you know, if you went to a bar and said, I want a Miller, they said, well, this is a Bud bar. There's a Miller bar 2 miles away. And that is how the rest of the world operates, is in a two-tier system. So, you know, you've got this industry where you've had two amendments to the Constitution. No other industry has had that. And so, you know, we look at it from a safety and regulation standpoint. How do taxes get paid? If you're self-distributing, can the state regulate that? Do they have the resources to actually police what's going on? We have a new chair of the Michigan Liquor Control Commission, Pat Gagliardi, who's been on the commission before. He's been involved in policy issues on the safety and regulation taxation of the industry. And I would love to see the new chair with the governor's office and the legislature actually conduct a policy discussion about what is that we want that would include the idea of, if we're going to have self-distribution for small breweries, what is that proper level? You know,
so you think some sort of commission should be formed to study what the right barrel number would be?
I think it's not just that, but it's should it just be a total open marketplace so that a town of 1,000 people can have 100 bars? Mm-hmm. Or do we want to have some regulation like we set up coming out of Prohibition? And probably it's somewhere in between there, but we haven't had that discussion. We keep plugging in different pieces into the law, but nobody's taken an overarching view of what is it that we think is good for the people of the state of Michigan. So yeah, I would love to see with some legislators, with the governor's office, with folks in the industry, to get together and try and come up with what we think is really good policy for the state.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Larry Bell. He's the founder of Bell's Brewery based out of Kalamazoo. So with the rapid expansion within the past decade or so of craft breweries, why haven't we seen that discussion come up, do you think, in the past couple of years?
It's a complicated issue, even for people in the industry, mm-hmm. understanding all the laws that are on the books and the whys and wherefores. You know, we tend to forget history, and Prohibition is way in our rearview mirror now. So I think legislators hear from different constituents about what to do, and they want to help their constituent out. And that's happened without thinking about what is the bigger policy picture. And again, I think whatever policy we have, it needs to be fair for everybody in the industry, and not saying we're just going to have special carve-outs for different people. How does that fit into the overall way that Michiganders think about selling alcohol, taxing it, and making sure that its availability is conducted in a safe manner?
With Michigan's self-distribution barrel number still being the lowest in this immediate region, are we risking losing some of these competitive breweries to other states surrounding, like Ohio?
I don't think so. We continue to see a lot of new players come into the industry. Personally, I don't think that it's affecting our competitive nature here. I mean, right now we're actually, if anything, we're seeing a correction in the state. The last 2-3 weeks have been a bit of a bloodbath.
Oh, how so?
With various closings and mergers and acquisitions in the state.
Oh, sure, with Founders and Roque.
Founders,
well, yeah.
Roque, Arcadia, mm-hmm. Dark Horse, Boatyard, Rupert's. You know, especially in my little corner of Michigan, we certainly have seen some significant changes.
And how do you see this as a correction specifically?
It's been very easy to get in the marketplace. There's been very low barriers to entry. It's easy to buy cheap foreign equipment and get set up. We've been on, you know, the longest economic expansion that we've had in a long time. And so a lot of people have jumped into the industry. We saw the same thing happen in the late 90s. People who weren't necessarily beer people thought, I'll get into this because I can make money. And it doesn't always work out. We probably have too many breweries right now for the marketplace to support. And that's what we're seeing. I wouldn't call it a bubble, but it's a mature market, and we're starting to see a lot more people exit the industry these days, and that will probably continue through 20 and 21, especially if we have a downturn in the recession, or a recession, a little downturn, yeah.
I think the argument that Dane would present from Eastern Market is that even if the threshold to get into the business is very low, that it's very difficult to grow at all with the self-distribution level where it is, and that would artificially force people out of the industry. What would be your answer to that?
Well, like I say, everybody that's successful in the state has been able to do it before. So I'm not sure why now things are different. Yes, there's more players out there, but we did it when people weren't interested in craft beer and wholesalers wouldn't talk to you. So I think if you're at 1,000 barrels and you've established your name, there is somebody that's going to want your beer. The Wholesalers Association's been very clear that they're willing to have their wholesalers take on product. And again, so when you get to 2,000 barrels, You know, it's if you give a mouse a cookie, right? Creating unlevel playing fields, you know, do we want to do this with other industries as well? And Michigan is unique. The car people certainly will be watching this because if you have a carve out here, this could lead to Tesla, right? So, and how do we conduct business?
So you're saying that this is going to essentially be not case law, but it's going to present a case for other potential litigation or policy changes.
The two industries certainly do watch each other. I can tell you that. I own an old Checker that was built in Kalamazoo that was sold under the Tesla model. But like I say, there's no reason that you can't work within the system. You know, well, you'll hear the argument, well, I just want to deliver across the street. Well, I deliver, my beer gets delivered across the street to countless number of bars. What's the most efficient thing is to use a wholesaler? From an environmental standpoint, do we want 400 breweries all delivering in their trucks across the state? No, that's not a very efficient way to do things. Do the restaurateurs want 400 different breweries all calling on them every week? No.
Right.
The wholesale system is the most efficient way, cost-effective way to get beer to the marketplace. And for small brewers, we're at 1,000 barrels now. Additionally, there's the tax break that small brewers enjoy in this state that I don't know that is enjoyed in the other states that you're speaking of. I'm not sure about that.
If the current law is 1,000 barrels and the petition right now is asking for 30,000, is there a compromise that you think could be satisfying from all angles?
Laura, I can tell you that everybody in the industry is discussing that and where that may be. And if there is a number there, then are there other caveats that need to be addressed with that from a policing and regulatory standpoint? You know, if it can't be policed, if the state says they can't really police this self-distribution, then maybe there'll be increased fines for violations. Or if you want to do more self-distribution, then perhaps tap rooms close. You know, you tend to see the big guys sitting on the sidelines on this because they would love for us.
When you say big guys, do you mean like Budweiser, Anheuser-Busch?
I mean the international brewers.
Okay.
Yeah.
Heineken.
Miller Coors, Heineken, ABI, because they would love America to go the way the rest of the world is, where they control distribution and they control bars. And that's the concern, is sometimes it's the law of unintended consequences of we're going to have self-distribution. Anheuser would love to have self-distribution. And in other states, they are allowed to own distributorships, and it's a two-tier system. And from there to be able to control bars, which, you know, they're doing that all over the world. So you tend not to hear them get involved in this. You craft guys, go ahead and have at it.
Larry, before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you about the future of the industry in the state. Maybe it's just my sort of egocentric, geocentric view of things, but I do view Michigan as a leader in this industry. And do you think that we are going to continue to move into that space and own it? Or is it something that you think will kind of, you know, be more middle of the pack?
I think we're still up there because we have a great reputation. We are just seeing, you know, a lot of change here in the industry. Most of the large breweries in Michigan now have a relationship with a macro partner, and there are more to come.
Is that ever going to happen to you?
Not as long as I'm alive. but there are other deals in the works as we speak. And how those all go down, that may change things. But those sorts of things are happening in other states as well. So I think because we have some interest in agriculture here, in growing hops and growing barley, and because of just our general agricultural state of fruit, which can be put into beers, that gives us a leg up on other states to be able to source locally and do things that can't be done elsewhere.
And you think there's still space for a future Bell's as well? You know, a couple of guys living in a house brewing beer in their basement?
Absolutely. You know, if one thing has been clear in this industry is there continues to be innovation. You take a look at a brewery like M43, Old Nation making M43. Boom. All of a sudden, here they come, right? So somebody with a good product, and I will note, I believe they did it all through the distribution system. So if you got a good product, something new, you innovate, you can go out there and do it, and sky's the limit.
Larry Bell, thank you so much for joining us on Stateside.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. I'm Laura Weber Davis. Cynthia Canty will be back tomorrow. Thanks for listening.